The Lost Ballparks Podcast is on the air.
Hello, everybody. This is Jack Buck with Carl Erskine at Municipal Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri.
From sunny Shive Park in the city of Philadelphia.
Brought to you direct from Comiskey Park.
So we have action at Ebbets Field, Brooklyn. And there's always action here.
Across the field in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
Sunny day here at Tiger Stadium. The wind blowing straight in from right field.
Well, friends, here we are back at the Polo Grounds in New York City.
So full of a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shaver or two throughout the evening.
Our guest today is the longtime voice of the Texas Rangers, Eric Nadell.
Harry to the set, now to the plate. Cruz is swinging a high fly down the left field line. It is hooking deep in the corner. Way back, that ball is history. A walk-off grand slam for Nelson Cruz.
Eric Nadell is in his 43rd year calling games for the Texas Rangers. In 2014, he was given the prestigious Ford C. Frick Award by the Baseball Hall of Fame, and he is my guest today on the Lost Ballparks podcast. It's great to have you on. Eric, you good?
All good.
Okay, so to start, May 5th, 1957, you attend, as a little kid, your very first Major League Baseball game at Ebbets Field. What do you remember? What stands out to you about that experience?
The first thing I remember is walking out into the stands and seeing the field. And it was really the first time I'd seen a major league field in color. You know, TV at the time was just black and white. So to walk out, I remember we had seats right behind home plate, to walk out and see the whole expanse of Ebbets Field, the bright green of the grass, the, you know, bright billboards on the outfield fences, you know, I was just overcome. And then the game itself, I remember that the number two hitter for the Braves, they hit a couple of home runs, and he was this real skinny guy, real young-looking skinny guy. And I asked my dad how he could hit the ball that far. And he explained to me that it was all in the wrists, that he had really quick wrists. And that skinny guy was Hank Aaron.
And now Mr. Henry Aaron swings a base hit just as easy as you please. Boy, what a hitter.
Wow.
That's what I experienced in my very first major league game, was seeing Hank Aaron. And I went back and looked at the box score recently. He actually had four hits in that game.
And didn't you later on ask him or send away for an autographed picture and he sent one back?
He did. I actually had this little scam going when I was probably 13. I had written a letter to Bob Bruce, a pitcher for Houston, who was born on my birthday, and told him that I was born on the same birthday as you, and so you're my favorite player. Would you be so kind as to send me an autographed picture? And he did. And then it dawned on me, nobody knows what my birthday really is.
Right.
So I sent the same letter to Hank Aaron and Roberto Clemente and, you know, a bunch of other star players. And most of them sent me autographed pictures, including Hank.
Kids who are listening now are like, okay, write that down. That's dear Mike Trout.
That was before Mike Trout was getting, you know, bundles of mail every day.
Right, you know, right.
There weren't many kids doing that back then.
Well, you know, it's interesting here in 1957, just as you're getting into baseball and attending your first games at Ebbets Field, unfortunately, the team would uproot and move to Los Angeles at the end of the 57 season.
And so it's come down to this, September the 29th, 1957, and the final game of the year, the Dodgers and the Philadelphia Phillies.
Do you remember that move? Do you remember hearing the news and being crushed by that move? Did it affect you as a young guy?
It affected us dramatically. Gil Hodges lived right around the corner from us. He was kind of the neighborhood hero. Sandy Koufax lived, you know, maybe a mile away. And, you know, the Dodgers were an integral part of the neighborhood. And the thought that they were going to move to Los Angeles all the way across the country was just horrifying. I obviously didn't understand any of the business part of it, being 6 years old. I just knew I had learned to love those players and they were going to be gone. And we weren't even going to have a National League team, that all we would have was the Yankees. And I'd already been taught that the Yankees were evil and you know, you're supposed to root against them.
So were you around when Ebbets Field actually came down? And I'm just curious, did you ever drive past it during that process or when it was empty?
No, I really wanted nothing to do with that. It was so sad. And my dad was a dentist and his office was actually pretty close to Ebbets Field. And so I was in that neighborhood a lot. In fact, when I was in college, I was actually a mailman one summer, a letter carrier in that neighborhood. So I've seen the plaque saying this is where Ebbets Field used to be, you know, by those apartment buildings, but never really went to that site specifically, you know, to grieve.
So it's interesting, your dad was a dentist close by, because there was someone, a Lost Ballparks follower, this was several years ago when we posted a photo of Ebbets Field, and this woman said that she remembers being at the dentist office close to Ebbets Field and thinking about what was happening at the ballpark. I wonder if that was your dad.
Maybe, although I would imagine he wasn't the only dentist on right. Fish Avenue. You know.
When the Mets began play in 1962, you're 11 years old. Were you able to see them play when they first started at the Polo Grounds while Shea Stadium was being built?
Absolutely. We went to one of the first games there. I think it was against the Cardinals. And then I remember urging my dad, and this became a big family controversy, urging my dad to take me to see the Dodgers when they came in.
Well, hi, everybody. This is Bob Murphy with Lindsey Nelson and Ralph Kiner, all set to bring you all the action from the jam-packed Polo Grounds this afternoon as the New York Mets welcome back into New York the Los Angeles Dodgers.
It was Memorial Day weekend. It was going to be their first visit to play the Mets in New York. And my dad absolutely would not take me because he knew that Walter O'Malley was going to get a certain portion of the ticket price. And he wasn't going to put a single penny in that guy's pocket. And my mom convinced him to take me. So not only did we see one of the first games at the Polo Grounds, we actually saw a doubleheader between the Dodgers and the Mets on Memorial Day when the Dodgers came in for the first time. And in that game, the Mets turned a triple play. Elio Chacon was the shortstop, and he leaped up and he caught a line drive off the bat of Willie Davis, and with the runners going, easily turned it into a triple play. So, you know, here I was barely 11 years old getting to see a triple play on probably the seventh or eighth baseball game I'd ever attended.
And surreal, this moment, because here's this team that you used to love and root for, and now this new team that you're not sure, but maybe kind of pulling for.
Yeah, we were rooting for the Mets, and they had about a half a dozen of the old Dodgers. You know, whether it was the right thing to do or not for the development of the franchise, it was the right thing to do for ticket sales to have Gil Hodges and Duke Snyder, Don Zimmer, Roger Craig, Charlie Neal, five guys off the top of my head who I can think of, who were original Mets who had been with the Dodgers and were pretty well past their prime.
What did you think, by the way, of the Polo Grounds? I'm curious, did you come down Coogan's Bluff to go in that way? Or do you remember how you got into the ballpark?
I remember we drove through some pretty dicey neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know, it was in a part of Harlem that was pretty dangerous back then. In fact, I remember kids throwing rocks at our car.
Wow.
As we were driving around looking for parking places. So I don't really remember that much about the neighborhood other than that we felt it was dangerous.
Yeah.
But I do remember the ballpark itself. It was just so enormous, you know, compared to what Ebbets Field had been. And the length of it, the full expanse of center field, though, was just daunting. And it just looked so different from Ebbets Field, which is the only big league park that I had been to for a National League game. In the meantime, I'd been to Yankee Stadium a few times, which was also gigantic. So to have seen all three of those ballparks, you know, within a span of just a few years was an incredible privilege.
Back in the day, couldn't you get into a Mets game for a buck with a student ID card?
Yeah, I remember it being $1.30.
$1.30, okay.
When I was allowed to go on my own, which was when I turned 13, I was allowed to start going to games, both baseball games and also games at Madison Square Garden. It was $1.30 to get into the upper deck with a student ID card, either at Shea or I think Yankee Stadium might have been $1.50. The amazing thing is you could go to Madison Square Garden and see the Knicks for 50 cents if you would sit in the balcony, or the Rangers for $1.
And so at 13, you're just taking the subway with some friends, or?
Exactly. The subway was 15 cents. You're hopping on the subway and you're going and, you know, spending $1.30 to buy a few hot dogs for 20 cents each.
Yeah. It's a great day.
Yeah.
So you've been broadcasting Texas Rangers ball games since 1979. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you got the bug one day to become a broadcaster when you're 7 years old, riding in your dad's DeSoto convertible. I think it was a weekday afternoon. Your dad was on his lunch break, and you're listening to a Yankees game.
There go the runners. The fastball is swung on and drilled into deep left center. Mantle racing hard and makes the catch, and the side's retired. And
at that moment, I think you had an epiphany. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, I remember we were stopped at a light on Bedford Avenue.
Mickey took off for the crack of the bat and made a fine running catch.
And it just dawned on me that these announcers somehow got off work that day to go to Yankee Stadium. And I asked my dad, how'd they get off work? And my dad said, no, that is their work. That's their job. And I said, you mean you're going to go back to the office in an hour and you're going to fill some cavities and these guys go to Yankee Stadium and watch games and blah, 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 blah about them? And he said, yeah. I said, Dad, they have a better job than you do. I think that's what I want to do. And, you know, he explained to me that, well, you know, there's only 16 teams and each team, I think, has two announcers, maybe three. So, you know, there's less than 50 jobs in the whole country doing this. So, you know, maybe you should set your sights on something a little more secure.
Or at least have a plan B.
Yeah. And the plan B, you know, was always go to law school. And, you know, my parents were always urging me to take the law school route. But at the same time, you know, they bought me a tape recorder, a little reel-to-reel recorder, when I was 13 or 14, so I could turn the sound down on the TV and make believe I was broadcasting games, or take it over to the high school field, you know, and make believe I was broadcasting a game. And they sent me to Northwestern my junior year in high school for a summer program for kids interested in broadcasting. And so, you know, I can't thank them enough for being supportive, as much as they encouraged me to, you know, think in terms of doing something else. They really did everything they could to help me pursue this career.
And in high school, in the mid to late 1960s, there was one broadcaster in particular that really made you fall in love with the art of broadcasting.
Yeah, well, that was Marv. Marv Albert was doing radio for both the Knicks.
This ball game's not over. 93-87 the score.
And the New York Rangers. He had this incredible deal where he didn't travel. He just did home games. Their road games were on TV. So I don't think they were on the radio. I think the home games were on the radio and the road games were on TV. So he just went to Madison Square Garden every night and did whatever game was being played there. And I would listen to every word. He was so exciting.
Come on, Rue. Baseline jump. Yes. 86-77. It's down and nine. Frazier steals from Robertson.
I would make sure I had my homework done in time, where I could just lay down on my bed and close my eyes and envision, you know, what was going on the court or on the ice, because he was, you know, truly a master of painting the word picture.
And it's funny, because you would tell people when you were growing up, when they would ask you, what are you going to do with your life? You might say to them, well, I'm going to be the next Marv Albert and be the voice of the Rangers. Well, I mean, at least you got the name right, right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't specify which Rangers when I was praying for my future career. And then, you know, eventually I got to meet Marv Albert and tell him, you know, how much of an impact he had on me. And he seemed truly appreciative. I also got to meet Mel Allen, who was the first baseball announcer who I really remember falling in love with.
Bobby Richardson, Tony Kubek, and Mickey Mantle will be the first three men up and last of the first.
He was doing This Week in Baseball started doing the Ranger job, and he would be at Yankee Stadium much of the time when the Yankees were playing, and I got a chance to visit with him, explain that to him. I never got to meet Red Barber, who was the other Yankee announcer at the time, and you know, I certainly wish that I had.
The sun is trying to break through. The field is in excellent shape. Nice crowd on hand. But there are plenty of seats and people in the neighborhood are still coming. This is the first of a doubleheader. So all you folks who are in the vicinity, just get right on your mules and come right on in.
But I did get to meet Lindsey Nelson, actually, when I was in college. You know, he was the original voice of the Mets.
And I should imagine we might have a few fans listening in tonight who haven't done so before. We've got tonight people on tonight with early morning baseball in New York. So welcome aboard. We're always glad to have you.
And I got to talk with Lindsey for quite a while, and he actually gave me a little pep talk when I was a freshman in college, you know, about pursuing broadcasting and being persistent and not getting down if you don't get your first couple of jobs. And that was a real revelation, you know, to actually see these people as real people rather than just idols of mine.
You spent the first part of your career in the broadcast booth at Arlington Stadium, home of the Rangers from 1972 to 1993. For those who never made it to that ballpark, how would you describe Arlington Stadium?
Well, it was a minor league park. It was actually a pretty good minor league park that became a, quote, major league park by adding 20,000 bleacher seats. There were actually more seats in fair territory than there were in foul territory when the Rangers started playing there.
It's still a little hard to believe, but big league baseball has finally arrived here. Jim Green, Channel 8 News, on the move at Arlington Stadium.
I wouldn't say it was one deck. It was maybe one and a half decks of seating. And it was very open air. There was no shelter at all. And there was also no protection from the wind. in Texas in the spring and summer usually has a violent south wind. At that time, it was always 20 miles an hour and gusting to 30 or more, blowing straight in from right field. For power hitters trying to hit the ball out to right field and center field, it was a complete nightmare. For broadcasters, it was a nightmare unless you brought a whole bunch of paperweights to the booth. You know, all these little paperweights that we get for speaking at Rotary clubs and Kiwanis clubs and things like that. We needed those things in the booth because our papers would fly everywhere. The one advantage we had going for us in that ballpark was the design of the windows in the broadcast booths. They opened up and down, and we had the ability to open the window partially so that we could see and hear the crowd, but we didn't have to open it all the way to get the full brunt of the wind. That's what kept it in some way manageable. When the new ballpark was designed, which is now the old ballpark, the second ballpark, Rangers Ballpark in Arlington, we urged them to have the same type of windows because not many broadcast booths are designed that way, with windows that slide up and down. We told them it was really important to do that because of the wind. They completely ignored us. They designed the new park with windows that slide to the side, as most do in broadcast booths, so that they're either completely open or completely closed. And once they were completely open, it was complete mayhem in there with the wind. And it also blew all the hot air in so that the air conditioning had no effect whatsoever. It was actually quite a bit cooler in the booth in the first ballpark here than it was in the second ballpark.
By the way, I did love the scoreboard at Arlington, the one that was shaped like the state of Texas. I think that was there until maybe the mid-80s.
Yeah, that was really cool. It was, you know, it was pretty funky and definitely Texas. There, you know, there was a lot in that ballpark that was iconic Texas sort of stuff, even as you walked around, you know, the very limited concourse. But, you know, if we got rain in that original ballpark, there was almost no place to hide. There was so little of a concourse for the fans to go that it was murder. And it was also a very difficult park for us to work in because there was no direct access for us to the field or the clubhouses. We had to walk through the crowd. You know, there wasn't a tunnel system. We literally had to walk down through the crowd to get to the field and step onto the field in order to go into the dugout and then into the clubhouse. There was no other way to get there. So after a game, for example, if we wanted to go down there, we were like salmon swimming upstream. We're going down the steps to the field and all the fans are coming up from their seats.
Well, and I can imagine that there, a lot of people want to stop and talk to you about the game. Hey, what did you think of that play? What, you know, and you, oh, hang on, I got to get down.
Exactly. So what I used to do, in fact, we didn't have dugout lines back then in order to do post-game shows. We actually had to do them in person. So what I would do is when I was the second or third announcer and I would be the one doing the post-game interview, I would go down during the ninth inning and actually sit in the stands in the closest aisle seat I could find to the field. And the second the game ended, I would rush down to the field and jump onto the field, you know, to grab the player that I wanted to have on the post-game show. And then I would actually have to record it in a cassette recorder and then run it up to the booth to play it because we didn't have connections to the dugout. You know, I guess they hadn't invented that yet, or maybe that ballpark just wasn't wired well enough to be able to do that. And so that was a different challenge, you know, that went away once we moved to a newer park that had all the connections where you could just put a guy on the headset in the dugout in the clubhouse.
There are a lot of characteristics that make a ballpark unique: the scoreboard, dimensions, advertisements, but also the ambiance, the PA announcer, the organist like Nancy Faust at Comiskey Park for so many years. And at Arlington, the playing of Cotton Eye Joe during the seventh inning stretch. I'm sure for visiting fans who had never been to a game at Arlington, maybe for the first time, they were like, what's going on?
That's what I thought the first time I went to a game. When I moved to Dallas, it was to do minor league hockey for the Dallas Blackhawks, who were the Chicago Blackhawks AAA team at the time. And I remember going to a game, and I had been to games, of course, at all the New York ballparks. I had been to games in Chicago during the summer I spent at Northwestern. And for me to go to a major league game and have that going on in the seventh inning, you know, I'd only been in Texas probably for a week. I'm thinking, where am I and what is this? But it came to grow on me.
During your Hall of Fame broadcast career, Eric, you spent an untold number of days and nights at Detroit's Tiger Stadium. What do you remember about those times on the corner of Michigan and Trumbull?
Well, that was the best located broadcast booth ever anywhere. You know, it was a little crow's nest that hung almost right above the backstop. It was the best view. It was so low, we could hear things that were being said at home plate. I remember one game where Bobby Valentine came out before the game started. He was managing the Rangers, and the Tigers had a sinker ball pitcher pitching that day. I think it was Dan Petrie. And they had softened the dirt in front of home plate with a whole bunch of water so that the ground balls wouldn't go anywhere. And Bobby came out there and was arguing with the umpires that this was unfair, that this wasn't in any way normal. The groundskeeper came out, and Bobby and the groundskeeper were shouting at each other. We could hear every word in the booth.
That's so great.
That was a bit of a problem, but not nearly as much of a problem as the day Charlie Huff had such a good knuckleball that Gino Petralli couldn't catch it. And Gino that day tied a record with 6 passed balls.
Wow.
And every time he would come to the backstop to retrieve the ball, he would yell his F-bomb a little bit louder. And by the third one, it was crystal clear on the radio. And I remember it telling our engineer, who normally didn't pay much attention to the game, hey, I'm sorry, you really have to watch the game when the Tigers are batting. Because as soon as the ball gets past Petralli, you need to turn off the crowd noise mic. And that was my most vivid memory of that park. In addition to the fact I did my very first game there.
Your first game was there?
Very first game was at Tiger Stadium. It was a really cold day. And that day we weren't able to use the regular broadcast booth because they had had a fire in the off season. We were actually working from up on the roof. I remember having to go down after the game to do a television interview with Fergie Jenkins, who had pitched a complete game. And I was so nervous that day that I had gone to the bathroom during the 7th inning stretch, and I tore the zipper on my fly. I couldn't get my pants closed. And I hadn't brought a coat. I just had a sport jacket. But my broadcast partner, Frank Gleiber, who was quite a bit larger than me, had a big trench coat in one of these Hank Stram, Andy Granatelli, Columbo trench coats.
Yeah.
He loaned that to me. So when I went down to do my first television interview as one of the new announcers for the Rangers, I was wearing this coat about 5 sizes too big, interviewing Fergie Jenkins on the field. I'll never forget that about my first big league game at Tiger Stadium.
We had your old broadcast partner, John Miller, on in season 1, and he raved about the press room at Minnesota's Metropolitan Stadium.
They had a great press room down deep within the catacombs of the ballpark. And man, that was the best one in the American League.
Do you remember it being like that?
I remember it being a wood-paneled room. You know, it almost seemed like a lodge, you know, like some sort of a private men's club lodge with dark wood paneling. And back then, you know, there were guys lounging around smoking cigars and smoking cigarettes in there. And it would be open after the game just as a bar. And so many great baseball conversations were had in there. And it seemed every time we went to Minnesota, we'd have a rain delay. And during the rain delays, we'd go in there. And yeah, he was right on that one. That's the most memorable press room that I can recall. Tiger Stadium had a really good one too. It was also wood paneled. And depending on who the chef was in any particular year, the food there could be really good or not so good.
I'd like to take a minute and talk about Nolan Ryan. I want to start with what I've heard is, I think, your favorite Nolan Ryan story. The day at the ballpark started with you interviewing Randy Johnson. Can you talk about what happened next?
Yeah, Randy had thrown a near no-hitter the day before. He had lost it in the 9th inning. And I had gone down there. You know, sometimes you go down to do a pregame show and you're not sure who you're going to interview. You kind of have an idea, but the guys are frequently not available. And I went down there, and Randy wasn't my original plan because I had heard that he was a little bit gruff and reluctant to do interviews, especially with people he didn't know. And I'd never met him. So I went down and I was on my way to the clubhouse. And again, in that ballpark, you had to walk through the dugout to get to the clubhouse. And there was Randy standing there by himself. And I thought, let's give it a shot. I mean, this is this budding star, and he almost threw a no-hitter yesterday. And I said, hey, Randy, would you be willing to do a 5-minute pregame show? I'm Eric Nadel, blah, 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 blah. And he kind of rolled his eyes and said, okay. And So we did the interview, and that was kind of his attitude on every question. He pretty much rolled his eyes on every question. And the tone of his voice made it clear that he wasn't happy about any part of this interview. And in the second half of the interview, I realized that if I took a different tack, he might do a little bit better. He wasn't that interested in talking about himself or the near no-hitter. But once I started asking questions about the team and the future of the Mariners and all that, he perked up a little bit. But it wasn't until the second half of the interview after the commercial. When the show was running, I'm sitting in the booth, and as soon as the first half of the interview was over, the phone rang in the booth, and the engineer answered it, and it was Nolan Ryan. And he says, this is Nolan. Let me talk to Eric. I get on the phone. I said, hey, Nolan, what's up? He says, I'm listening to this in the clubhouse. He says, and I'm just loving this interview. I'm just wondering what you said to get Randy so ticked off. And I told him, I think what I said was, would you like to do the pregame interview?
Right.
And Nolan broke out laughing. And he said, well, I got to hang up. I can't miss the second half of this. I'm really looking forward to it.
That is so great. By the way, you called Nolan Ryan's 5,000th strikeout.
Here's the payoff pitch. He struck him out swinging. Strikeout number 5,000 is history for Nolan Ryan.
What do you remember about that moment in baseball history?
Yeah, I was really fortunate to get that strikeout in my innings. You know, I worked with an amazing announcer for 13 years named Mark Holtz, and he would do the first three innings and the last three innings. And so he would have all the dramatic moments, generally speaking. But the 5,000 strikeout happened to occur in one of the middle innings. So I had a chance to call it. And I remember thinking that, you know, I didn't have much experience in calling big moments, but that it seemed that the thing to do was to kind of lay back after the moment occurs, let the crowd tell the story for a while, you know, let it breathe. But when the strikeout occurred, all of a sudden, all of the Rangers started sprinting to the mound. And that kind of disrupted my plan to not say anything for a while, because I'm the radio announcer. My job is to paint the word picture. And what's happening here is all of the players are sprinting to the mound, and that needs to be told. So it kind of altered the way that I finished the call. But I do remember that it was, you know, just this huge media event. And the Rangers had basically created this. John Blake, the Rangers director of public relations, had pretty much invented the whole thing. You know, nobody had ever had 5,000 strikeouts before. Nobody even had 4,000. And he just made up this whole thing about the 5,000 strikeout. And you know, they put out these lists of all the players Nolan had struck out and how many times he had struck out each guy and all the ballparks he had struck people out in. So they created it into a national media event. I was fortunate enough to make the call. And back then, you couldn't hear announcers all over the country, you know, unless they were on a really strong radio station and you made an effort to do it. And it was a big deal for me because my parents were in New York. And they actually got to hear my call the next morning on the Today Show because the Rangers did not televise the game. The Rangers didn't televise home games back then. A lot of teams didn't. And the, you know, the visiting telecast, for some reason, wasn't really picked up by a whole lot of people. And as a result, the Today Show ran the videotape with my radio call behind it. And I got phone calls from friends all over the country who had actually heard my voice on the Today Show and some of the national newscasts.
What a special moment, too, that it's not Biff Pokoroba, it's Ricky Henderson.
Exactly. And he had also struck out for number 4,998.
Later, Nolan talked about the specific pitch that got Ricky to strike out for number 5,000.
I had to make the pitch I wanted, and it was a fastball low and away, and from a pitcher standpoint, it was a perfect pitch.
And if you go back and watch that video, it's classic Nolan Ryan, because it's still the middle of the game, and he does not want the fuss or the pomp and circumstance. He's ready to face the next hitter. But what a moment at Arlington Stadium, and again, it could have been any other hitter, but it's a future Hall of Famer, Ricky Henderson.
It was pretty remarkable that that's how it turned out.
The Rangers began play, Eric, in 1972. And is it safe to say that October 12th, 2010, the moment the team wins the pennant for the very first time?
The Rangers are a strike away from winning the American League pennant. 6-1, the Rangers lead in the top of the ninth. Feliz the high set. Here comes the pitch. Breaking ball, strike three call! The Rangers are going to the World Series!
Was that the greatest moment in your broadcast career?
Yeah, by far. you know, much more than the 5,000 strikeout, or Mark Holtz and I got to call two Nolan no-hitters and a Kenny Rogers perfect game. I got to call a four home run game by Josh Hamilton and a 30 run game by the Rangers, which is the major league record. But nothing compares to the day the Rangers finally won the American League pennant. And the way it happened, where, you know, A-Rod was the last Yankee batter and struck out against our closer, Neftali Feliz, to send the Rangers to the World Series. The whole thing seemed surreal.
The tough part for Ranger fans, broadcasters, players alike, is that the following year in 2011, right back in the World Series, and this time, the Rangers are one pitch away from winning it all, not once, but twice.
Same game, they were a pitch away in the ninth inning and in the 10th inning. That was just absolutely crushing. I still get sick, you know, to my stomach when I think about it. It's still hard for me to go back to St. Louis, where that game six was played. For many years, I don't know if they still do, because we haven't been there in a few years. They still had the Gulf sign on the fence in right field, where Nelson Cruz did not catch the final out of the World Series. But it was terrible. And, I think about the Ranger fan community and how so many of us would look on this club in a totally different light if either Nelson had caught that fly ball or the lucky broken bat hit that Lance Berkman got in the next inning to tie the game had carried a little bit farther and been caught by Josh Hamilton for the final out.
Yeah.
I think the whole perception of the Rangers would be really different right now.
Hey, I'll get you out of here on this, Eric. You were inducted into the broadcast wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2014, a full circle moment in your life, because when you were 13, 14 years old, you went to summer camp in the Catskill Mountains, and you and a group of kids would make the trek down to the Hall of Fame game in Cooperstown sometime during the week. To think, as you were going there as a kid, one day your name would be immortalized there along with baseball's all-time greats. It's a pretty storybook capstone on a life and a career well-lived.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, it was completely, unthinkable. I had actually decided when I was in high school that hockey was going to be the sport for me. And when I went to college, hockey was the sport that I broadcast along with football. We didn't even do baseball. So for me to wind up in the broadcast wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame, it's absolutely crazy. And when I was doing hockey, Mike Emmerich and I were working in the same league. And Mike wound up being the best hockey announcer ever from the United States. And we joke about it all the time that he was a huge baseball fan too. Perhaps our roles could easily have been interchanged.
By the way, one final note, Eric, one of my favorite baseball books is something you co-wrote in 1989 called The Man Who Stole First Base, Tales from Baseball's Past. I've taken more than enough of your time today, but at some point I would love to have you back on to talk about some of the fascinating stories in that book. I've got that book highlighted front and back. There's so much good stuff in there.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, the guy who really created it was Craig Wright, and he still has, I guess you'd call it a blog that you can subscribe to called Pages from Baseball's Past that tells those stories, in written form with a lot more detail and a lot more photos. I'd recommend that people check that out and subscribe to that. It's not very expensive. But Craig actually wrote a pregame show that we did called A Page from Baseball's Past. I would give him some of the ideas for it, but he was really the creator of it. And he was largely responsible for that book. But it's a really entertaining book. We tried to find the most offbeat stuff that we could find.
And the podcast notes, we'll put a link to that, link to the book, and then also your limericks. I mean, people don't know, but you are the limerick king.
Yeah, I loved doing limericks from the time we started learning to write them when we were in junior high school. And a couple of years ago, the Rangers were having a really bad season. And we decided to start playing around writing limericks. We started rewriting some of the commercials as limericks, my partner Matt Hicks and I. And then we decided, hey, maybe we can keep our audience hanging around in these one-sided games if we just do a limerick every night in the eighth inning. And by the end of the year, we had all these limericks. And so I hired an illustrator and we put a book together, and with the proceeds going to the Rangers Charity Foundation. It's called Lim-Eric, and people can find it on Amazon if they're still interested.
We'll put that in the podcast notes, a direct link to that, so folks can check that out. Eric, thanks so much for the time. And on behalf of Rangers fans across the country, thanks for providing the soundtrack to so many summers over the past four decades.
Thanks a lot. It was fun being with you.
Man, it's hard to believe that he is in his 43rd year broadcasting games for the Texas Rangers. What an incredible career. And so much fun to talk to him about growing up, going to games at Ebbets Field and the Polo Grounds, and hearing some of his historic calls as part of the Rangers franchise. Real quick, if you've been enjoying the podcast, would you please do me a favor and take a minute to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify? Those reviews will help other baseball fans discover the podcast and also helps us book guests, too. So thanks for taking a minute to do that. Special thanks to the producers of the Lost Ballparks podcast, Manny Zavlakis, Michael Ortman, Xavier Guerra, Mike Dunn, and Briggs Buckingham. Also, I want to thank a friend of the program, Matt McWhorter. This episode absolutely does not happen without Matt's help. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it, man. Have a great week. I'll talk to you next Wednesday for another episode of the Lost Ballparks podcast.